Back again, or haven't you ever left?
Blake isn't a patient. He's a substance abuse counselor. And a damn good one.
Well, if anyone knows his stuff, it's you.
From Slightly Unbalanced, we are still Queer as Folk. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
We are back for season four. It has been over a month since we last chatted. By the time you hear this, it'll have been 2 months. It took us just over a year to record seasons one, two, and three. We've done 58 episodes so far. Small program note for season four of our podcast is that we will be posting every other Wednesday. 2019 is looking pretty busy for us with Matt's theater work and my travel schedule. So we've had to adapt our recording sessions for that.
But let's get down to business. Remember to check us out on Instagram and Twitter at StillQueerAF and on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk, where we continue the discussions of the episode. We also have a website where you can leave us a message to play on the air, and that's at StillQueerAsFolk.com/hello.
Today, we're talking about episode one of season four, and it's called Just a Little Help.
It first aired on April 18th, 2004, just over 15 years ago.
Ouch. It was directed by Kelly Macon, his fourth of 11 episodes behind the camera.
For the fourth time, showrunners and executive producers Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman wrote both the story and teleplay for the season premiere.
As you recall our last episode, these are the episodes that I hate the most, when Cohen and Lipman write both the teleplay and the story.
Yes, you are most decidedly not a fan. But I have to admit, I was quite taken with this beginning of season four.
Yeah, I loved it.
So, well, we look forward to breaking down what we feel they did right.
I have notes.
I think we both do.
Here's what happened in Just a Little Help. Having lost his job and a pile of money exposing Police Chief Stockwell, Brian finds himself falling on hard times financially, though he refuses to admit it. Gardner Vance offers him his old job back, but turns him down because he would have to sign a non-compete agreement. Instead, he tries to start his own boutique agency, but none of his former clients follow him. As Brian runs out of options and lists his loft for sale, Melanie and Lindsay organize a fundraiser to get him back on his feet. Sort of a modern-day GoFundMe event.
Yes, but not for Brian, but for Concerned Citizens for the Truth.
For the Truth. Citizen.
Citizen. Single. In the B story, Ted works his way through rehab with Blake, where he receives a surprise visit from Emmett, creating even more friction in their aborted relationship. Ted checks himself out of rehab after a week, only to run into Emmett at their condo. That's really Ted's condo. Out of options, Ted becomes suicidal until Emmett sternly shames him back into rehab.
Good job, Emmett. So in the C story, Michael and Hunter are still on the run. We kind of forgot about that.
They are a regular Thelma and Louise.
Until Michael catches Hunter blowing a truck driver to get cash for junk food. They return to Pittsburgh and find themselves in a custody hearing with Hunter's mother. Not surprisingly, Melanie loses yet another court case, and Hunter remains safely ensconced with Ben and Michael. I wrote this synopsis myself.
It's
a little editorial.
I think there is definitely some op-ed happening in these recaps here. So Just a Little Help has an 8.7 rating on IMDb. Half the people rating the episode gave it a full 10.
I agree with them. The episode was smart. I liked it.
Yeah, I thought it was very cleverly structured and uses devices to carry all of these storylines so well together that I was very pleasantly surprised, given the track record for this show.
I kind of thought it had the usual Queer as Folk gaps and fumbles in it, but the stories were good.
Yes, they were definitely, what's the word I'm looking for? Engrossing.
Story driven.
Sorry. I felt the stories were rather engrossing, even though I think some moments we got a lot of telling and not showing.
One thing I liked about this episode were those six musical bookends. They were hosted by a new character, Chandelier, or Darren, as he is known outside of drag. He was played by Ryan Kelly, who appeared in four episodes total.
And Chandelier is such a clever drag name. I love it.
Yeah, did we look to see if there's another chandelier out there? Was this stolen?
I don't think there is. I like to think I know quite a few drag names out there, and one like Chandelier would have stuck out for me. Like Karen from Finance. That's one of my favorite drag names ever.
Is that that's a real one?
Australian drag queen named Karen from Finance, and I think it is the best.
I think my two favorites are two old Chicago drag queens. There was Frito-Lay.
Yep.
And Remy Martin. Love those two names. There was, of course, in Chicago, there's a character called Miss Fousey, beloved by all.
I don't know that one.
Oh, you're too young.
Oh.
I'll have to bring you up to date.
Yes.
She did this great video that was the intro to the Mary Tyler Moore Show, where she was running through downtown Chicago.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Loved it. I'll show you after we get off the air.
Great.
So the songs here, I did some looking to figure out what the meaning of these songs was. So the first one was What I Did for Love. Kiss today goodbye. Tell me about this song, Matt. So you're just like chomping to get up to your microphone there.
What I Did for Love is from, of course, A Chorus Line. It was one of the climactic songs in the show. And if you don't know A Chorus Line, which if you're a gay man, how do you not know A Chorus Line?
I don't.
Okay. Well, A Chorus Line is a show from 1976. It was one of the first musicals to win the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. And it is a show that was based on interviews that Michael Bennett, famed director, choreographer of the musical theater, who did interviews with actual chorus members, you know, of different musicals, and what it is that they were hoping to get out of just getting the chorus gig. And it's about their hopes, their dreams, their failures, their successes. And What I Did for Love is one of the more well-known songs from the show.
So this was used to bookend the Brian is broke story, and Justin's offering him his rage money. And Justin brings Brian into the fundraiser with the same song. The next one was called There'll Be Some Changes Made by Mildred Bailey. That had to do with Ted in rehab. Ted was making some changes. And from now on, there'll be a change in me. The third one was Cry Me a River by Julie London. And this is where Gardner is offering Brian his job back. You say you're sorry for being so untrue. Well, you can. And something I didn't know about Julie London was it's the same Julie London that went on to be Nurse Dixie McCall in the 70s TV show Emergency.
Emergency? Wow.
I came across that show on like antenna TV, you know, where you plug an antenna into your television.
And I may be young, but I'm not that young. I do remember an antenna on the TV.
This local station was showing Emergency over and over, and I was just enraptured by this show because it was like so very 1970s, and it was great. And Julie London was a nurse on it.
Is this sort of like a precursor to ER?
Well, the show was actually a spinoff from Adam 12, which was a spinoff from Dragnet.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's some TV inception there.
Yeah. The fourth song was I Only Have Eyes for You by Helen Forrest. I don't know if it's cloudy or bright, 'cause I only have eyes. And this is where Brian is meeting all of his former clients. And then the final one is Great Day by Lena Horne. As the gang's exiting, Woody's in. Darren is being bashed in the alley. Six little moments in the show. Five songs, and I thought it really, really tied together the script well. I was really surprised by it. As soon as it started, I was thinking, oh no, what is this going to be? But it worked. I was surprised.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the way it was edited so precisely, like they use it to deliver us right into the next scene. That was very clever.
Yeah, they overlap.
Yeah, it worked very, very well.
I feel like the Darren bashing story, which goes across several episodes, would have had more impact if it was a character that we already knew. Instead, it was like a brand new character. Because if you're going to gay bash a character again and then roll credits over silent street noise and sirens, it's got to be somebody that we're already attached to. With Chandelier, we only had 5 or 6 musical numbers to fall in love with her. It didn't seem as impactful as it could have been if it was, say, Uncle Vic in his pulling out his gowns to reincarnate his drag career.
So I think this is the moment where the series is trying to make a broader statement. Whereas we had the gay bashing with Justin at the end of the first season was very personal. Here, I think to juxtapose the actions of what's happening to Darren with the happy-go-lucky nature of all the characters we love leaving the bar, I think shows that we're dealing with a broader issue and that not everything is so happy with for the characters. I think this is what the series starts to do in its last two seasons, where they're trying to make a broader message rather than just these people that we've come to know.
Yeah, and this bashing takes on a much broader context later in this season with Justin and his pink posse.
Yeah, antics. Exactly. Yeah. It's going to be used as a catalyst for actions that our other characters take.
Yeah. It just, when I was first watching, I was thinking it was sort of like the light beer version of Justin getting bashed. Mm.
Well, and I tell you what, it was very effective for me because of that last intercut of Darren and drag as Chandelier, because all the other musical numbers were done with this beautiful steady cam. It flowed beautifully. Here, the editing was a little more frenetic and a little grittier and a little more violent to match the violent actions mm-hmm. towards Darren. And it worked very well for me.
So the A story here is Brian is broke.
Yes.
Thank you. The theme in this part of the episode carries on that risk everything mantra that we saw in the season 3 finale. Brian had reversed course after supporting Stockwell and literally risked his lifestyle to save Gayopolis from tyrannical mayoral rule.
He went for broke and got broke.
Yeah. This storyline really required some suspension of disbelief to enjoy it, though. Last season, we talked about how Brian's financial situation couldn't possibly be quite so precarious.
Yes, because he lives such an extravagant lifestyle that for some reason, $75,000 or $100,000 that he uses against the campaign uses as the campaign against Stockwell doesn't seem that much of a reach for him.
Yeah. And apparently he had no savings.
Well, apparently Brian was living paycheck to paycheck.
So he sold like $75,000 worth of belongings, and he also had that easy out with Gardner Vanso because he offered him his old job back. So if he was really in dire straits, he could have just taken that job. So this was feeling a little manufactured, but I did appreciate that Brian took the risky path, which was to bet on that uncertain future of starting his own agency. And that's a quality that I've always liked in Brian, whereas I think a play it safer would have just taken the job with Gardner Vance and accepted the new rules.
Yeah, I felt like Gardner was willing to give Brian basically the keys to the palace.
Yeah, and the jacuzzi and his private bath. Unlimited and expense account. That was a little hokey.
Right. And then to say, okay, I'll give you whatever you want, just sign this. And I thought it was a very shrewd business move on Brian's part in saying, like, yeah, there's a reason why you want it to be non-competing. It's because you know I'm the competition. You just have me working for you, and that terrifies you. So, of course, I'm not going to sign this.
You're not giving yourself enough credit.
I'm giving myself all the credit. I brought in all of our major accounts. I created their campaigns. I convinced the world it couldn't live without their products. And they would leave with me faster than a 10-second spot. But if I sign this, they'd all be off limits.
Interestingly enough, this is pretty much the last time that Brian is ever going to be in financial difficulty for the rest of the series.
As with a lot of storylines in this series, they will be in trouble for all of 42 minutes.
Yeah.
And it will work itself out.
That's why I thought it was disappointing that the writing team didn't take him further down the destitution path.
Yes. Like, what if he actually had to sell the loft?
Yeah.
What if we lost that? That would be a huge turning point.
Well, because he spent what is apparently his life savings, all of his money, sold all of his furniture, his paintings. He sold everything but Justin's ass. But then he recouped it all within 2 episodes.
exactly? Like, what? Really?
Yeah, it would have been much more interesting just to see him really, really, really fall down further instead of this Superman, super gay.
Yes, and we already know that Brian has such an ego that he's like unwilling to accept help or assistance or, but it felt like everyone was trying really hard.
Yeah.
And I think they were pushing that. The fact that Deb is like, no, you'll pay me back when you have it. And the same thing with everyone. And I can see how that can bruise someone.
But it didn't hurt enough to really matter to the overall series long story of Brian.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been better if he really couldn't afford that lunch, if he stopped eating at the diner, if he stopped having Chivas Regal at the bar at Babylon. It was just too quick, and he didn't fall far enough for the story to really grab hold of anybody. I did find some gaps in this story. It's just, how much money did they raise for Brian in 2 days? Apparently it was enough to get him back on his feet again, because
yes,
it never comes up again.
Because they were doing such a wonderful job in terms of selling how destitute he really was. They kept saying, I've never seen so many zeros in his credit card statements, and how terrifying it is that it's that time of the month where he has to pay all of these bills and there's not much left. But one little fundraiser and
in the midst of all these other fundraisers that are going on that we learn about.
Yes,
probably the most able and most capable person of earning, pull money away from all these other worthy charities to get him back onto his feet in 2 days?
apparently Brian is
he's more important.
Well, what probably works against, say, the Gay and Lesbian Center that was so quick to back Stockwell, thanks to Brian.
Oh, right.
Is that they were backing Stockwell, and then all that came out.
Yeah.
So now people are like, well, no, we don't want to support the organization that was behind Stockwell, who turned out to be a conspiratist prick. We're going to go and support the one that exposed him. That's grassroots right there.
We had talked about the non-compete, and I wanted to revisit that because I thought there was a little bit of a gap here. If you remember back to season 2, when Gardner bought the agency, Brian made the same play.
I have the relationship with the clients. If I go, they go.
Before I acquired this firm, I learned everything about it, everything. I also contacted every one of your clients, and they agreed to stay with or without you.
This non-compete seemed a little contrived to me. Do you think that this really was Gardner Vance protecting his flank by rehiring Brian? Because it didn't seem that way to me. It seemed more like he really wanted him back. It's like, here, have a whiskey. I'm happy. You're back. I missed you.
Yeah, I feel like
it got a little bro-y there, and I was like, oh, he really does miss him.
I feel like the non-compete is not what he would have wanted him to sign. I feel like maybe it would have been a non-disclosure or something like that, based on the work they had done for Stockwell, that could have been stuff that they were privy to.
Sure.
You know, something to that effect, rather than Gardner Vance doing something that would drive Brian away.
Yeah, I mean, non-competes are pretty common. They're also pretty illegal in several states, especially in tech. Tech companies always want engineers, especially, to sign a non-compete so that they don't take all their knowledge to a competitor. Yeah. The other part is, unless you're like the genius of the entire company, you're not going to be chased by your former employer. It just doesn't make financial sense. It doesn't make a good public relations event. It scares away other people that you might want to work for you. So this was just kind of a funny little pivot of why Brian was going to start his own agency. Why didn't he just start it?
Yeah. Here you have a clean slate here. Yeah. It feels like cheap drama to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because then if you cut out the Gardner Vance situation, what we're left with is the moment where he's trying to win back his clients. It's like, I know these clients will come with me because I brought them to the agency, so I bet I can win them over.
Great. We heard that before.
Yeah. It's like, we don't need the Gardner Vance anymore.
I did like that they actually brought back all the same actors for those clients. Like, they had the son, or the glasses woman. They had the brown athletics guy. There was the steakhouse. Eat the meat. That guy.
Yes. Well, and
they all came back. I like that.
And what I really liked is during that sequence, I'm thinking, and he's just going to win his clients over, and he's going to have his own agency, and it's just going to be that easy.
Ta-da!
Great. So then for it to be revealed that he didn't win them over, I was like, ah, you clever show. You didn't play your easy card.
Yeah, except he didn't win them over. He still starts the agency anyway. He still succeeds wildly. So it's like, all right.
You don't have your old job, you don't have your old clients, but you're going to win anyway.
There was another kind of gap in the story. Not really a gap, just sort of a weird thing where Justin offered Brian money from his Rage sales.
Look, we sold almost 3,000 copies of Rage on the net last month alone. I could give you some money.
No.
Why not?
I'm not taking your money.
I thought we were partners.
We are.
Then why won't you let me give you money?
Because I don't need your help. I don't need anyone's help.
So let's assume it was like $5 each. So that's $15,000.
So it's like what, a tenth of the
15%.
Debt. 15% of the debt. Again, how much debt he's really in.
Surely Justin needs that money far more than Brian does. So once again, it's like the people that are more in need and more deserving of the money are trying to give it to Brian, who's the most capable of earning the money.
Yeah, and that's let's continue this discussion about Justin, because it's also unclear if they are in fact living together.
Yeah, where does Justin? He was at Daphne's, right?
That last we heard, he was at Daphne's, but then Justin describes him as Brian's partner.
New terminology.
Well, and then I'm like, when you say partner, do you mean romantic partner? Do you mean business partner because of the bankrolling with Rage? Like, what? It's terminology that.
Yeah, because they were talking about Rage. Yeah. Brian became sort of a silent partner in Rage when he funded the ad campaign in the party. Maybe they were talking about business.
Yes, because I think he's more of the producer of.
I like the double entendre of it, though.
We don't know. Listeners, do you think they meant romantic partners or business partners?
Let us know. Yeah. And also let us know if anyone has seen Justin actually work recently. I don't think he's taken a shift at the diner in a very long time.
He was too busy trying to tear down the Stockwell campaign with his political art.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, he was the intern.
Yes.
He's probably an unpaid intern.
Oh, absolutely.
So Justin's angle of, here, let me give you 15 grand. Well, actually, it's probably not, because Michael probably had, you know, his share already. I think a better story angle might have been Justin having to feel very helpless as he watches the once almighty Brian crumble into poverty.
Poverty.
Instead of saying, here's $7,000.
Yes, very quick to throw everything at it to try and help.
Something else that I thought was funny is that Justin is the one that named Brian's new agency, when in fact, Brian kind of does this professionally, like naming things.
I was going to say, he knows how to brand.
Exactly.
That's why he's ad exec of the year.
Let's go with the 19-year-old intern that dropped out of the Pittsburgh Institute of Fine Art, and let's have him name it.
Yes. I do want to do a quick shout out that in all this money woe that Brian was selling the loft and that Jennifer Taylor was going to be the one to sell it.
She's a realtor now.
She's a realtor. She seems to be doing very well because she was willing to not charge the commission to sell it. And I love how she describes the loft.
I mean special as in it's for a certain kind of person, a person who's has no children, who's single, a person who, let's face it, Brian, it's a fuck pad.
You know what? I love her growth as a character. She's the most interesting person. She's the most supportive, and she looked great in that suit.
She did.
She is a business woman.
There was something that Brian said that we need to comment on.
Hey, let's grab a drink. Better be the fine print. Another fucking benefit. Wonder what the worthy cause is this time. Send a tranny to summer camp?
Oh, come on.
That, ooh. Yeah, that immediately dated the show. I think it was 2007 when Christian Siriano brought that word tranny front and center when he said hot tranny mess and the whole world erupted. That was the first time that I can remember the word tranny becoming pejorative.
I feel like if you go back to like the era of Tu Wong Fu, because I know that there's a whole sequence where they're discussing what is the difference between a transsexual, transvestite, and those, I mean, are extremely dated as well now.
When a straight man puts on a dress and gets his sexual kicks, he is a transvestite. When a man is a woman trapped in a man's body and has the little operation, he is a transsexual.
I know that.
When a gay man has way too much fashion sense for one gender. He is a drag queen.
Thank you.
And when a tired little Latin boy puts on a dress, he is simply a boy in a dress.
We all know that using a phrase like tranny does not fly today at all.
Yeah, and I just couldn't figure out when this became a thing because it almost used to be acceptable to use that term.
Yeah, there was a thing where it was a slang that we felt we could say, but now in an effort to make sure that we are supporting all those in the queer community, there's even a drag queen in Chicago who has rebranded themselves from that, which I think is very, very, I think very supportive and very smart on their part.
Who is that?
Tranica.
Oh, Tranica Rex.
Formerly Tranica Rex, now goes by T-Rex.
Ah, I didn't know that. Yeah. I'm out of touch with the drag scene in Chicago.
Well, T-Rex has been hosting the Drag Race watch parties at Roscoe's, and it's been great. She's hilarious.
Still queer as folk. There's more on the way. The B story in this episode is Ted in rehab. This story had Ted coming to terms with what he did while he was an addict. He does his group therapy, elocution, which was pretty gut-wrenching to watch. Well played by Scott Lowell.
Yes, that basically the recap of what brought him to rehab was pretty hard to watch. And then I'm just imagining like those in the group, especially Blake, because he has a prior relationship with Ted, to hear what Ted went through and then still not try and find a way to be comforting while still having the boundary of being the counselor is a difficult thing to watch in that scene.
There was also a funny look from two of the extras that were also in the group therapy session. I'm not sure what that look was. It was a little bit of, and a little bit of, yeah. So I just thought it was weird.
Well, because I would assume that not everyone in this rehab is gay.
Good point.
So I don't know.
I'm surprised the show didn't make it a gay rehab.
Right. But yeah, I was operating on the assumption that these are drug addicts first and not necessarily homosexual. So to hear that the person sitting across from you was gangbanged in a in a drug-induced
state.
Yeah,
that can be a little surprising to straight people.
Right.
One thing that I don't believe happens in rehab anymore, at least in the US, is being forced to scrub the floors.
Yes, as some sort of therapeutic tool or like to earn your keep there. It's very little strange. But we also, this is when we finally get a timeline. This, when we go to the rehab, that's when we know that he's been there for 3 days. Mm-hmm. So we know from the end of season three to now, it has now been 3 days. And I'm shocked that Ted has, I guess, worked through his withdrawal. Like, I see no symptoms of that here.
He's well, just if Mel and Lindsay can come up with $100,000 in 2 days, Ted can certainly work through withdrawal in three.
He got through a coma in 42 minutes. Yeah. So.
Ted's not dead.
So, yeah, there were just things in this that just didn't jibe with me in terms of
the timeline had to be accelerated. Well, I guess it didn't. It's like, why not keep Ted in rehab the entire season?
Yes, let him learn to grow and heal.
Fall off the wagon.
Yes, have a relapse and go back. And
yeah, I thought this was a predictable TV rehab story.
Yes, it's as easy as 1, 2, 3.
Well, I had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. A person realizes they have a problem, check themselves in.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do a little bit of cognitive behavioral therapy. An antagonist character appears. Person checks himself out. Runs into important person who cajoles them into returning to rehab. Lather, rinse, wow, repeat. Yeah. That's the TV formula for sending somebody to rehab, and it played out here.
To a T.
Yeah.
Because when Emmett and finally, well, it did not finally, Emmett finds out that he is in rehab, that he has checked himself in, he goes and visits him, and it's a very antagonistic union. It's not a supportive, I'm glad you finally did this, and then he's, Emmett sees Blake and he throws some petty shade at Blake. And
yeah, let's talk about that, because why was Emmett so wrapped up with Blake being involved here? Did he feel threatened by the presence of Blake?
He must have, because he still equates Blake with Ted's near death.
Back again, or haven't you ever left?
Blake isn't a patient. He's a substance abuse counselor. And a damn good one.
Well, if anyone knows his stuff, it's you.
Yeah, he's been amazing. Yeah, I don't know what I would have done if he hadn't been here.
Look, I just came to make sure you're all right, and it seems like you are.
But, you know, that
no
was,
second chance here for Blake.
Oh, not at all. Emmett is not a forgiving person in this moment, which is kind of sad. I would have thought that Emmett's like, oh, here's someone who clearly made it through. If he's here being a counselor.
Yeah. And
someone
Emmett's,
can learn and grow and do it.
Emmett trolled him right in his own workplace.
Yes.
And he's there. You know, he showed up to work.
And shout out to Blake for sort of just taking it in stride. Yeah. And knowing that people are in an emotional state and I'm going to do my best I can to help them along.
I still like this story though. It's just a massive evolution of the Ted character, and no other character in the show other than Ted undergoes such a massive transformative story arc throughout the entire series.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, Ted's kind of the most interesting character on the show.
Oh, from the beginning. Yes. And I think they have an asset in Scott Lowell to pull that off.
Yeah. There was something that I didn't really like in that scene in Ted's condo where Emmett shows up to pick up some of the equipment and Ted just happens to be there. Ted just like snapped on him. I thought that was okay. Expected for the drug addict to snap at Emmett. But it seemed really dangerous for Emmett to walk out on Ted right after Ted threatened to kill himself.
with such derision and almost encouragement from Emmett.
Yeah.
Like, I know you're trying to reverse psychology him, but this is not that moment.
Yeah, right.
This is not that moment to do that.
This is dial 911.
This is, you stay right there. I am calling the rehab people and I am like, it's something, yes, something to that
bring
effect.
The straight jacket. He's exactly. Dangerous.
Yes. He is willing to harm himself. You need to deal with this. Here it's like, no, I'm going to give you really tough love and that's going to help you. What?
Goodbye.
Right. He just slams the door on him.
I'll come back tomorrow to check. It wasn't even that.
No, there wasn't.
It still seems wild that Blake would be at all involved with Ted's treatment.
Yes, we've brought that up before where we felt that it was a little conflict of interest.
They were lovers and he, you know, almost killed Ted.
Yes,
with GHB in season one.
And I'm sure Blake is not the only counselor in this rehab.
Yeah, or in all of Pittsburgh.
In all of Pittsburgh.
Nevertheless, it was really good theater. I thought those stories worked well.
Yes.
And you just need to roll with it.
Yes. And to have, and I like that Blake, because clearly Ted was willing to hitch his post right back on to Blake because Blake was there. And we have that moment when they're scrubbing, when Ted is scrubbing the floors. He's like, now that you're here, I can make it through this.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I got a date. I got to go.
Yeah. And by the way, we're going to the opera.
Which, again, thanks for turning me on to that.
We're seeing Ted's rehab from two different perspectives. It's useful to see how Ted's addiction is impacting his ex-partners, both Blake and Emmett. Too often in rehab stories, we only get one side of the picture. We get like the person on the inside going through it. Having Emmett get sentimental about Ted's orchid just reminds us that Ted's actions throughout all of season three had this big blast radius around him that other people almost went down with the ship. That's something that you just never see in rehab stories.
This is still Queer as Folk, and there's more to come. Stick around.
We forgot about Hunter and Michael.
Right? And apparently the police did too. So
the story of Michael risking it all to save Hunter didn't really go that far. It was a nice cliffhanger last season, but what was the net result of going on the lam anyway? The only thing I saw was Michael hashtag adulting for once when he's had enough and heads back to Pittsburgh to face the music.
The re-entrance to the storyline is that Ben is confronted by Hunter's mother right away, like outside their apartment. She knows where they live. She says, where is he? You know where he is. Where's my son? What have you done with him? And she's being really scary. And they're just saying like, we don't know. He ran away again. And Michael is out trying to find him. And it brings back the point of, why did you not just call your friend Melanie the lawyer from the very beginning?
Yeah, it was just such a poorly conceived plan. They take off with a handful of cash in Brian's Corvette, a convertible Corvette, no less. How far was that really going to get them?
Not far at all. Michael is...
I mean, what's next?
Right. And Michael is at least clever enough to know that they can't use credit cards because they can use that to track where he is.
Oh, but then his cell phone rings and he picks up the phone.
We're running out of cash fast.
You have a credit card.
If I use it, they can track us. It's Ben.
Dude, what's up?
They can't triangulate, but I guess this was early enough in cell phones where they couldn't triangulate someone's.
Oh, well, I'm sure there was no GPS on his flip phone at the time.
On a singular wireless flip phone, yes.
But they could certainly track down the general area that he was in.
Oh, absolutely.
I just thought it was a really awkward timing where he's just saying, we can't use the credit card. We'll show up on the grid. Phone rings. I feel like this story could have been written as them hiding in the attic of Melanie and Lindsay's house and had the same punch to it. They didn't have to like go to this motel out in the middle of nowhere.
Seedy motel, wherever they ended up, however far they got.
The cliffhanger in this motel seemed like drama for drama's sake. There was other ways that they could do this. It's almost like the writer of the cliffhanger at the end of season three had one story in mind, and then Conan Littman came back and said, yeah, that's not working. Let's bring him back real quick.
And I don't really understand what the end game was in running away. Was it just to get him away from the mother in that moment?
Yeah, for a day or two.
And thinking she'll like get tired and leave?
Yeah, and I think I would, if I was Michael and Ben, I would have put trust in Hunter. He's a wily youth. He's been on the streets. He's been in countless men's apartments. He went to the murderous cop, fucked him. I guess he got fucked. Kept the condom of jizz. This kid is streetwise.
He's clever.
Yeah, he could escape from his mother with without even missing a beat.
Yes. Like, what is she like?
All of a sudden, it's up to Michael to like save him. He doesn't need saving, though.
Absolutely not. Because then Hunter.
He's the artful dodger.
And he also relies on old tactics to get the money.
A little fun fact about that motel scene is the beer commercial that Hunter was watching on TV in the intro stars Robert Gant.
Yes, it does.
That was great. Great little Easter egg.
It's really funny. The first time I watched the episode, I was like, that guy looks familiar. What is it about this? I was like, wait a minute. Oh, I would have been like, oh my God, that's Ben. I would have laughed really hard if they just like, leaned into it.
So this story ties itself up really quick. We never see Rita Montgomery again.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Can we talk about the tactic? Again, this is why Hunter is street smart. He knows his mother better than anybody in that courtroom. So here he is.
Let me stick my tongue in your mouth, Mom.
He doesn't even do that. He really just sort of just kisses her on the mouth.
That looked like such an awkward kiss.
Yes, it did. And then he said... Then he mentions that he's HIV positive, and she has her freak out in front of the judge.
Jenny, I forgot to tell you. I'm HIV positive.
It's not very funny, Jimmy.
It's true. Ask them.
It's true.
Oh. Oh, you fucking dirty little faggot! The fuck, you trying to give it to me? Huh?
Miss Marcus, Mr. Landry, may I see you?
And it's like, he's like, I know what will freak her out. Let me do this. And I'm surprised she didn't try and like scream like they're lying or he got it from them or something. Like that would have been.
I think she did. Didn't she? Oh no, she turned to Ben.
And he goes like, yeah, it's true.
Yeah. I made a list here of awkward Ben lines in this episode. So the first one was when he encounters Rita Montgomery on the street.
Because keeping a kid away from his mom, that's called contributing to the delinquency of a minor. And if he took him, that's kidnapping. I could have him arrested.
You wouldn't do that.
You wouldn't do that? Really, Ben?
I think she's 100% prepared to.
she's doing it. So like, it just seemed like a clumsy line for one of the lead characters.
She already brought the police once. Right. So And that made your boyfriend go on the lam. So, yeah, she's willing to do it.
Okay, so hits and misses this episode. My hit was Brian having the courage to walk away from Garner Vance's offer. Love those gutsy moves and characters, not just Brian. And so the play at Safers. I guess that it would be expected that Brian would do that. Of course, it fits in with his character. This was probably a bigger risk it all moment than Michael just hitting the road with Hunter with no plan and like $100 in cash.
Hoping for the best.
Yeah, that one had an obvious conclusion since they have to come back to continue the show.
Yes.
That would have been a good spinoff, like Hunter and Michael on the road.
I love that. That would have been great. Yeah.
What was your hit?
My hit would be the drag queen edits that tied all of our stories together. I just thought it was so effectively used, and I enjoyed the lip syncs, and the technique of it was just so clever and something that I don't think we've really seen in this series, a way to really tie every single storyline we're seeing using that device. I thought it was just very clever.
So this is the first episode that we recorded since Netflix dropped Queer as Folk.
Yeah.
So I'm curious what the streaming version would have for those songs. I wonder if those songs were licensed for the streaming version. The show is still streamable on Showtime.com. I don't know anyone that has Showtime.
Right. Whoever has premium cable is able to. I mean, does Showtime do like an HBO Go kind of thing?
Where they you
can
do.
Just, okay, yeah. So then maybe that's a way to do it. Or you can do what we do, which is watch the DVDs.
Yeah, so if you did not watch this on a DVD, let us know what songs you heard on it. We'd love to hear how that played out. Misses. My miss was the story about Hunter and his mother wrapping up in one episode. 5 minutes of screen time, and he's safely back into the breadbasket of Ben and Michael for the rest of his life.
Yep.
All done.
That is my miss, too. That is my miss, too. I had such a problem with the way the show wanted to tie up storylines by
it's like fixing
telling,
everything from by, season three.
Well, yeah, and a lot of it was telling and not showing. Like, we are told that Stockwell was indicted and he is being forced to resign. There's even that scene where when Mel and Lindsay are walking through the neighborhood and we see one of the leather daddies holding the newspaper, holding it up, and just so we can see the giant headline that says Stockwell indicted. And I'm like, that's all we're going to get. We had like literally a season of him being a villain and all we're just being told, yeah, he got indicted.
Yeah.
And then the same thing with Hunter's mother. She has this outburst in the courtroom, and next thing I know, Hunter's there at the fundraiser. All we heard the judge say was, I want to see you all in my chambers.
I don't even think it was chambers. It was just like, I want to talk to you.
Yeah, it was.
I want to leave the room.
The judge said, I want to see counselors in my chambers. And then next thing I know, we're at the fundraiser and Hunter's there. So we're like, I guess it all worked out. And then Melanie tells us that Hunter is okay to stay there for as long as he needs.
It was Mel explained to us.
There you go. Done.
This has been episode 1 of season 4, and it was called Just a Little Help.
Next time on Queer as Folk, Brian starts his own ad agency.
Just Add Water.
Watch it grow.
Ted graduates from rehab with Blake by his side.
Michael and Emmett go on a retreat.
Oh, I love that storyline. Justin decides to join a gay vigilante group. That will be episode 2 of season 4, and it's called Stand Up for Ourselves.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF, and you can find us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk and can continue the discussions there.
I'm on Instagram at Patrick Randall and would love to connect with all of you. Please follow me.
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed your time with us, please give us a positive review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to listen to us. And until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.